Phil Kogan's on vacation. He's away in the service for 2 weeks. And I have a guest here, a young gentleman who has listened to the show from the very first one, Harry, in June. Mm-hmm. Somebody lives on the Monterey Peninsula, Harry Powell, and he and his wife have listened since the very first show I had, and they tape every show. You have every one of them, right? And they've
missing two,
and we'll get those caught up. And Harry has turned on a lot of people to the reading material and to the research, and he is reading many, many books. They're a perfect couple. They're just the way I wish every listener would be. They're his father. Oh. You find it interesting?
That's kind of interesting, I think so.
What book are you reading now?
I'm reading The Third Reich, and I'm also going to get into the Ross book.
Invisible Government?
Yeah, The Invisible Government.
Yeah. The Third Reich is a good one to read now at election time when you see how the government is manipulating the courts of law. And you're talking about the Justice Department, the Third Reich.
Yeah, I just finished that chapter.
Yeah, the political assassinations are so closely related to the overthrow of Germany after World War I and then the people that moved into this country, the Germans, and the effect of the political assassinations in this country, that if you sit and read that as a textbook, that's a good place to begin to understand Dealey Plaza. So Harry's going to participate with me today and talk about Dealey Plaza. We'll use the format that we do every week on the show, take the news of the week and relate it to the past political assassinations. There was a building that burned down in Dealey Plaza, the Texas School Depository Building. And some of you that are too young,
school book depository,
I should know it by now. Some of you listeners are not aware of all the controversy that centered about that building in 1963, 64, and 65. And hopefully the people that were involved in the assassination wanted the controversy to end. We'll discuss what happened in that building briefly, and then we'll discuss why the building was set fire 2 days ago. The sixth-floor window up on the left far side was where Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to have been at the time that John Kennedy was killed. As soon as the law enforcement officers came to the building and went right into the building, Oswald was downstairs at the Coke machine on the second floor having a Coca-Cola. The elevator was broken. No one in the stairway, after all that excitement, saw him running down the stairs. He's never been identified by any person as having been seen on the sixth floor of the building. He was down there having a Coca-Cola when the policeman entered the building. The researchers took the movie, the famous Zapruder movies, and recreated the shooting of John Kennedy according to the time frames of from the moment he was shot in the movie until his head was blown off, and they recreated it into so many seconds that the car traveled and the shots could take place. And in that amount of time period, the gun that Oswald was supposed to have owned, which he didn't own, could only shoot 3 bullets. So in reconstructing the crime in Dallas, the killing of John Kennedy, they had to allow for only 3 bullets and no more. Have you read any of those books, Harry? Justine's book?
Yeah, I read Justine's book.
Yeah, the controversy. Of course, you met Sprague when he was here, Richard Sprague, who recreated the time thing, the problem with the bullet, and Cutler, who had a whole lecture and a book on the...
I didn't read Cutler.
Oh, you haven't read his book? Well, the point was that Lee Harvey Oswald, if he had been in the sixth floor and if he had owned a gun, would have shot John Kennedy in the back, 5 5/8 inches below his neck, and the bullet had to exit, be the same bullet that went out of him and had to exit in his Adam's apple, which went uphill, which is against the law of physics. And from the sixth floor of the depository, the direction of the bullet would go straight down. So they were stuck with a problem because one bullet exited, and they locked up the x-rays of John Kennedy's body. They're locked in the National Archives as long as you want them locked up. Right now the government says 75 years. We're trying to get them open. The x-rays were never used by the Warren Commission to show how many holes were in John Kennedy's body. And his coat is locked up for 75 years. It would give the answers to some of those questions. But a year ago, a man bought the Texas School Depository Building because he was interested in reconstructing what he said the history of the Kennedy murder. And he collects items from the Kennedys, I don't know what he has that isn't in the Kennedy Library, books and information, facts on the assassination. Mm. He's from Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Mayhew, and he bought this Texas School Depository building, and the city of Dallas was simply furious because since the assassination, no one's ever been allowed on the sixth floor to examine the window where Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to have shot. And from the fifth floor window, some people were up there, and the Warren Commission went to the fifth floor, not to the sixth, because that even makes the bullet going higher up when you're shooting down. So the Warren Commission went to the fifth floor, and the photographs that they took out the window, there was a tree directly in the way of the scope if Oswald had shot from that window. Other researchers have said he shot from other windows. On the gun that shot Kennedy from the back, one of the bullets came from the sixth floor farther down the hall, but it wasn't where Oswald was standing. But the window has never been able to be used. No one has been allowed on the sixth floor since 1963.
Yeah, the only tests run it were by the Warren Report.
And they didn't go to the sixth floor.
No, they didn't go to the sixth floor.
And then CBS had a show, and Jim Garrison arrested Clay Shaw. Then CBS and NBC wanted to come in and show that the Oswald shooting was the accurate report and there was no conspiracy. So they again duplicated the shots with a gun that wasn't Oswald's at all, that didn't even, when the Warren Commission tried to duplicate it, they couldn't do, you know, what the best marksmen in the country tried to do. They couldn't duplicate Oswald. And they didn't use the sixth floor. So they were left with the coat of John Kennedy, which is locked in the archives, and the x-rays of his body, which is locked in the archives. And I brought in a list of things that have been destroyed that we'll never see forever. But they were left with this school building, and this man bought it, and it belonged to an oilman by the name of Harold Byrd. So in November 71, there was a big fuss in Dallas about buying this building, and a lot of people came up with offers to Mr. Mayhew because they realized that it would be possible to get access to that sixth floor. They didn't realize what this oilman was doing when he bought it. They thought he was one of them, I guess. So they sold it. So right away, offers came, and they wanted to tear it down for a museum. That was one of the offers. Tear it down and build a great big museum, a Kennedy Museum. Mm-hmm. And then the Dallas people said, no, that would be a honky-tonk tourist trap. Well, they didn't want too many people at Dealey Plaza. They still have hundreds every day, 400 or 500 people come every single day and take pictures of that corner. I've seen it myself. I went there, couldn't get in the depository. So they said, well, let's do some other kind of a museum. And somebody wanted to make it a wax museum, turn it into a wax museum, and have control of the building. And then there was another offer of $1 million to take the bricks away from the building, just take the bricks out, anything to keep that window from being available to duplicate the shots.
Somebody wanted to buy the window also.
They wanted to buy the window. Somebody said, let us just buy the window. What was that, for a horror museum? We're going to have a horror museum, they said. This is from the San Jose Mercury and from Newsweek, 1971, November. I'm reading an article here. We'll turn it into a, let us have the windowsill and the bricks from the building. We'll make a horror museum. And Mr. Mayhew said, no, I'm not going to do that. And we're not going to have a wax museum. We're not going to do that. And then they said, well, that building isn't safe. Just leave the front and tear out the whole back. And nobody could get up to it's ridiculous. So they said, let's tear out the whole thing. He said, no, he's not going to do that. That isn't what he had in mind. He said what he had in mind was to study the whole Kennedy assassination and see what happened. This is what he had in mind.
Continuing.
He wanted to make a continuous study. Mr. Mayhew came from Nashville, Tennessee, and said, I want to make a continuous study of what happened in the Kennedy assassination. Well, you can imagine how popular that was in Dallas, Texas. And so what he said, they were trying to take the building away from him in November. And Mr. Mayhew said, they'll take it over my dead body. I'll fight it with everything I have, and I'll take it all the way to Supreme Court. Well, since November, the Supreme Court is made up of Nixon's lawyers, so those avenues are erased anyway. You know, people have such confidence in this system. Like McGovern said, if I don't get those votes, you know, at the election, I'll take the Supreme Court. Well, luckily, he got the arrangement the way it should have been. But people have such confidence in the Supreme Court and the system that's oppressing them.
It brings to mind the way Adolf Hitler used the system in the Third Reich, all the way through the 30s. He used the same Weimar Constitution in order to pass all his laws, and that was the very constitution that he overthrew. So
yeah,
that was the constitution he used to make his laws legal.
Well, Inspection for Disarmament, that book by Melman, he tells how from the Supreme Court on down, all the courts of law had to be reversed and judges selected, so the innocent look guilty and the guilty look innocent. So Mr. May was going to go to a court of law, but he doesn't have to bother because this week the building was just burned down, the fifth and sixth floor, and they left gasoline cans all around to let him know what happened. And the implication was that he was behind on a payment with a Dallas bank. Well, if he wanted to burn his building down and get the insurance for it because he was broke, first of all, he could have made a lot of money just selling the place over again, a big profit. He could have made $100,000 just selling the bricks from the sixth floor window.
$350,000 because he paid $650,000 and he was offered $1 million.
Yeah, well, if he just wanted to take the bricks off the building,
$1 million.
He wouldn't have lost his payment. And they left, if he was going to burn it for insurance reasons, he wouldn't have left the gasoline cans on the fifth floor. It was just a flagrant, we'll show you how we're doing it. It was similar to the Ku Klux Klan type of thing, just burned down. They just left the gasoline cans. Didn't bother the bottom because there's nothing downstairs the people had wanted. Hmm. And they burned the fifth and sixth floor.
They know they won't be caught, so they...
And then the news coverage has a chance to get in their extra little dig. It begins this week. The UPI arsonist broke the book depository and spread gasoline over the floors and set fire to the 68-year-old structure where Lee Harvey Oswald waited to assassinate John Kennedy. They had to throw that in, you know, his lair. Well, at least they said he waited. They didn't say he did it.
Yeah. Well, the other article, the adjectives are very striking. The sick, young, self-styled Marxist sneaked up, waited, and fired. You know.
Yeah, they have to get the whole trip in for the generation who missed it. But that goes under destruction of evidence, and I put that in my filing cabinet in my head and will write a book on the evidence destroyed in these murder cases to hide who did the assassination. But I say now, you know, we keep asking to get the National Archives open to get the coat and the x-rays of John Kennedy. I don't even think it matters to get those things open. These people have been convicted and tried. That's just when there's so much evidence that there was a conspiracy that you'd have to figure out the mathematical chances of all this stuff being destroyed even just by accident. But I just brought on a list, and I've mentioned a few of the things on the program before. The medical x-rays that were never used, and the coat of Kennedy's that's locked up, and the car interior that was removed. And that car was sent immediately after the assassination to Michigan and airlifted to Dearborn, and the interior ripped out. So nobody could see if there were extra holes in the car. The clothing of John Connally was sent to the dry cleaner. The FBI never saw it or examined it. It was completely ruined by the time the doctors asked to see it, and the street sign in front of the book depository was removed, and the lamppost directly in front of the depository within hours after the assassination. And no one can find out who gave the orders, but I think the street sign was nicked with bullets, and frames of the Zapruder film were cropped. Life magazine bought them right on the spot at Dealey Plaza, gave $1 million, kept the films. The Warren Commission didn't use them for their work. The notes taken in the Dallas Police Department the 48 hours that Oswald was alive were destroyed. First they said they didn't take them, and then I have people, witnesses, saying they were there when notes were taken. Those were thrown away. John Kennedy ended up with two autopsies, one an FBI version that had an extra hole in his back that went finger length, and then the one that the Warren Commission used that the bullet exited as Adam's apple. And when they wanted to know the discrepancy on the two autopsies, they called Dr. Hume, the Navy doctor, did the autopsy, and he said he destroyed by burning his original orders. And Oswald's post office application, where he filed, where he was supposed to have received the gun, there's a postal federal law that it remained in the post office, your box application, for 2 years. And they wanted to see what names could receive packages at that post office, and they went there, and that was destroyed. And then Oswald went to an attorney down in New Orleans named Dean Andrews. And he had an honorable discharge from the Marines. And when he went to the Soviet Union, they changed it to dishonorable to make him look like he was not popular at home. He was going to give off the radar secrets. You know, that was, so he went to Dean Andrews, and there was a special slip, a special color card.
Standard procedure for us, intelligence.
To offer information.
Well, to fire him once he's done something.
Oh, yeah. And they gave him a dishonorable because...
Yeah, to change it to a dishonorable.
Yeah. I just have been reading this book on counterintelligence, the British counterintelligence. It's a new book that's out. And it goes into how when you make yourself desirable to the other party, you offer them information.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be true information or they will, you know, you'll blow your cover and they'll kill you. So you have to give them information. But the party you work for already knows that you're going to offer it and provisions.
So they give you false information.
So, well, they give you true information, but then they change. See,
well, like, true information that doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter. No, like Donovan in the Marines, the officer over Oswald, when he had top security clearance in the Pacific, he said that they routinely change all the codes after a certain time period. Oh. So when Oswald goes to the Soviet Union, said, I'm going to give you all the code names and operations for the Pacific, you know, and at mm-hmm. Sugi Air Base in the Philippines, and he had memorized all of them and was really sharp at that kind of thing. He offered them the real codes. Then the United States could say, oh, he's not with us anymore. If he's going to give our codes, we have to change our codes.
Well, that's standard, too. They always change their codes.
Sure. Yeah. But in the interim, before they could get wind, Oswald could say, well, I'll give you the codes. Yeah. And they could change them 1 month before they know they're going to change them here because then they're caught, you know?
That's no problem.
No, so in this case, he went to Dean Andrews, an attorney in New Orleans, because this was in September of 63. And after that assignment, Oswald was to go to Mexico, then Dallas, where he was to be a decoy. And he had applied for a university at Austin, Texas. He was supposed to start college as soon as he was cleared of this thing because he didn't own a gun. And he would be arrested while the real assassins leave town, you see, and he was framed. Well, he didn't know that part was going to happen to him. He was in New Orleans, and he'd come home from serving his time in Russia as an agent of the CIA and Navy intelligence. So he went to Dean Andrews, the assigned attorney, to change his discharge, and he was in correspondence with the Secretary of Navy, you know, at the time. And
who happened to be John Connolly?
John Connolly.
Don't let us forget that.
Yeah, and Fred Korth. Before Connolly, there was Fred Korth all the time that Oswald was Navy intelligence. Korth was the attorney for Marguerite Oswald's husband. And as a witness before the Warren Commission, she names Fred Korth. And when she wanted to get a divorce from Mr. Ekdahl, that was Lee's stepfather, Fred Korth, as the attorney, brought in three or four people that Marguerite Oswald had never met in her life when she was married to Ekdahl, and each one swore different things about her. So she knew that Fred Korth was in on framing Lee.
Yeah.
And she knew Lee was in Navy intelligence because he had brought in witnesses she had never met, and he knew that this lawyer was in the intelligence system.
And besides, she was KGB.
No, that was, you're talking about the wife, Marie. I mean Marguerite.
Oh, did you say Marguerite?
No, I mean Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, got a divorce from Mr. Ekdahl when Oswald was an adolescent, 14 or 15.
Yeah.
And the lawyer who represented her was Fred Korth, who became Secretary of the Navy, who was a big wheel in General Dynamics down in Fort Worth, Texas, and was president of the bank that got the contract for General Dynamics and the famous F-111 that Lyndon Johnson switched down to Texas for Fred Korth.
Infamous.
Each one scratches their own back. There's a network, you know, that goes on and on, you know, of people linked to each other. Yeah, well, Dean Andrews, the minute the assassination story broke, about Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans and things, the complete file of Dean Andrews' office were ripped off and everything that he had with the Oswald applications. And he said they had a special color to them, and I know this was a code name, you know, who to send it to. Hmm. Then Oswald's passport, in the Warren Commission hearings, he had a passport that was marked secret information on it, and it was in the State Department at the time of the assassination on November 23rd, 1963, it was burned. And a lot of his State Department papers were on the desk of the State Department the night of the assassination. So in volume 23 of the Warren Commission hearings on page 188, they asked one of the witnesses from the State Department about Oswald's passports. And they said, oh, the night of the assassination, that was accidentally destroyed while being thermofaxed. Well, that's just 11 instances of evidence destroyed. There's about 38 that we could go into, just like Jack Ruby. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about Jack Ruby's file from his office that was never opened, and it was just ripped off about a month ago. It went down to Texas. It was ripped off by the moving company, and it never was opened, never seen by the Warren Commission. Now it's gone forever.
And his possessions were auctioned off, weren't they?
No, one thing, the gun was locked up. His wife tried to buy the gun. and it's still in Washington, and some man from Oklahoma wanted to buy it right after the assassination.
Oh, yeah.
And a sale was made, and then another person who's clear conscience said, don't do that, save it around, because we have yet to see that gun fire those shots, you know, in 5 seconds. That'll be the day, you know, from the top of the archives. So that's evidence destroyed. And the article that you read in the paper about the book depository burning down is not as insignificant, you know, as they want it to be. Now, the way you handle espionage agents in foreign countries like Germany or Russia isn't any different than the United States. And a typical example is trying to make the particular agent, if he's caught, appear insane. In the Soviet Union, they send them to mental hospitals and say they're insane if they begin to talk or know too much. And in Germany, they would shoot them and say they were shot while they were trying to escape. America uses both systems. We're the best of all.
Anything to destroy their credibility.
Well, we're the best of all possible worlds. Like when they want to kill George Jackson, they were planning it down at Soledad for a year and a half. Finally, they just had to say he was escaping. You know, and I mean, it's just a big mess. And we, you know, there's certain people, revolutionaries or people onto the system in Attica, you know, they could take all of them in one fell swoop. And we do this all the time with guys that are escaping. But the people in power today are having a little trouble because one man who was supposed to die, George Wallace, is still alive. And he's very, very sick. Have you read the articles, how really sick he is?
Yeah, he's supposed to be improving.
No, I don't think
he's not improving.
I would be surprised if he made it. His physical condition is just terrible. Yeah, a bullet, he had just eaten lunch and the bullet punctured his intestines and they went all inside of him. And they had to take all of his intestines out of his ring and lay it on top of his chest and do a very complicated surgery and didn't get all of it out. It punctured a lot of spleen and the pancreas and everything. Yeah, I mean, he was really in bad shape. That's why they waited on the other surgery. And he has a lot of spunk, and if he lives, I think he'll follow this thing through. But
he seems to be recovering.
Yeah, the Nixon administration is trying to put off the trial of Bremer, and they've put it off now till July 31st. You know, they want to put off the Democratic suit against the Republican committee to investigate Nixon, the Watergate suit. Well, they're trying to put off the trial of Bremer. This is July 31st.
In the interest of national defense.
Yeah, and the excuse is we have to do a little more mental testing. Well, Bremer is really mad. The New York Times says Bremer, who's 2 years old, has refused to go to the state psychiatrist. They misprinted that. But he's not insane, and he's refused. Yeah. The New York Times says that he has refused to cooperate with medical or psychiatric examination. I think they'd make him a vegetable. I don't see how John Mitchell and Patrick Gray and Richard Nixon can survive if this boy survives. And I don't see any reason not to make him a vegetable because he's in a very delicate position because he was hired and he was seen with accomplices. And Patrick Gray is waiting to be appointed the head of the FBI. He's closed the case. It was an obvious conspiracy.
In 3 weeks, he closed the case.
In 3 weeks, he closed it. And nobody has said what members of the Milwaukee Club he associated with. This boy worked there 3 steady years. They keep referring to him as a busboy and janitor.
Nobody's told why he was staying at the Waldorf Astoria in, what was it, $80?
Lord Elgin, yeah, $80. Lord Elgin Hotel up in Canada.
Lord Elgin, yeah.
Sheraton Hotel in Maryland, you know, and was coming back for more reservations. Now it seems he took an airplane. He was going more than 1,000 miles a day and traveling all around. See, well, that's an obvious conspiracy. What are they going to do with Bremer? What do you think they can do with him?
Well, I'm glad it's their problem and not mine.
Let's put it this way. I'm glad it's their problem.
Yeah.
I'm glad that they have a problem.
Yeah.
See, what happens is, if Wallace had died, Bremer would have been given a deal like James Ray, like maybe with no trial. Or he would have been isolated like Sirhan and the other assassins. See, so now they're stuck with a man who isn't dead. He's just damaged for life and hanging between life and death. But they've stuck with Bremer, who could have access to writers or researchers or, you know, Computer and Automation came out with an article. We'll cover it next week. We don't have time this whole week. But it's on the shooting of Wallace. It's the newest issue. And for those of you who are new to the show, I bring up this magazine all the time, Computer and Automation. And Edmund Barclay is the editor. And it comes out of New England. And he's on his second year now. And every single issue, he has questions of political assassinations. And this issue is only on how many bullets were in George Wallace. You see, there were five in George Wallace's body, and you know, there were three of people staying in the shopping center.
Right.
And this article comes up with 10 wounds on four individuals. Wallace and a man and a guard and another lady. So you have...
From a five-shot revolver.
From a five-shot revolver. Does... You know, this is good that this is one of the first articles out on Wallace, because it's going right to the bullets. Does this sound familiar, where you have more bullets than a gun?
Familiar.
Yeah, with the Robert Kennedy shooting the ambassador, the LA Police Department has 10 bullets with an 8-bullet revolver, and Sirhan got off about 3 or 4. Oh, there was another question of destruction of evidence or terrorizing this week. Sirhan's brothers had a press conference and a TV show in LA. And they were talking about the fact that the truth should be told, that their brother didn't kill Robert Kennedy, and they want the evidence brought out, the ballistics brought out. And so this week, Mary Sirhan had a fight and said that her sons tried to burn her house down, and she called the police.
That first part of that, what you just said, was not in the papers that I read.
No. No.
The part about the news conference. The only thing that was in the paper was the fact that the mother was threatened by the two sons, and they didn't say why she was threatened.
Yeah,
isn't
that disgusting?
Yeah,
they do this all the time. They tell you that the house was going to be burned down. The mother's having trouble with the boys. I take 8 papers a day, and that I get in the news. But the question of the brothers having the news conference on TV or in L.A. came through the L.A. Times. And that wasn't in the papers. By taking 8 papers a day, it came through the L.A. Free Press. But I take the... L.A. Free Press, the L.A. Star, and the L.A. News Advocate. There's 3 underground papers, and they're carrying a lot of things.
Yeah, they're really good.
On Sirhan, and on Lewis Tackwood, and on all these cases, but you don't get it otherwise. And it's very important to take some of the underground papers and analyze what's happening. I got a note here. We'll take a station break. And I'll answer this postcard. I like to answer the mail. Someone handed me a note, and we'll take a break on.
So from A. Bremer?
All you have to do is say KLRB.
This is KLRB, and I have a guest here today. Phil Kogan's on a vacation.
KLRB Carmel.
KLRB Carmel, California.
Got it.
Okay, and Phil is on vacation, and I have a guest here, Harry Powell, a young gentleman who's been a listener to the show for a year, and I explained the first of the show, has read a lot of books on the subject, is becoming what the government, the establishment, doesn't like. They call us assassination buffs. You've joined the classification of buffs. You've read 3 or more books, and you're knowledgeable on most of the political assassinations, pretty much, and that's pretty good. I just had a postcard.
It's called Troublemakers.
Is it just a line to say every Saturday at 4, my 3 neighbors and my wife gather around and have coffee and listen to Mae Russell keep up? Question, what is going to happen after the Republican convention? Is Nixon going to run? Let me tell you, if you listen to the show every week, I did one 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago at the Watergate after June, when the Watergate Hotel was broken into in Washington, D.C. And that was where John and Martha Mitchell live, and the Republican committee broke into the Democratic headquarters. And I'm going to do a show next week on, I'll do on the Republican convention, because we're warming up. And what I would like to see, this is May's fantasy. May's fantasy would be that Richard Nixon doesn't run at all, that he's tried for murder of Robert Kennedy, and that Agnew be investigated for his connections to the secret clandestine government that is the hidden government that I talk about every week. For those of you that follow the show seriously every week, I've said there's 2 governments in the United States, and the elections are a mockery, and that there is no such thing as a 2-party system, and that if these political assassinations aren't discussed in the open, very soon McGovern doesn't stand a chance to live. I don't think he does. There's enough evil people ready to kill him, to cancel elections. And we're working against time now. We have till November. And I'm going down to L.A. in a week and a half and have a press conference. Mark Lane will be there. He's one of the first people to do research on the political assassination. He wrote Rush to Judgment. And Lewis Tackwood, the agent that I've talked about, who talked about the plans to overthrow the government that the hidden government have been arranging for several years, Tackwood has a book coming out called The Glass House Tapes, and I just finished a chapter for that book. And my articles will be out in August, How Richard Nixon Came to Power and the Watergate Affair. And hopefully, it depends how much of a news blackout there is or the response to this kind of information. There shouldn't even be elections until we go to the Los Angeles Police Department and count those bullets and look at the gun and find out if the man who ran against Richard Nixon in 1964 was killed so that Nixon wouldn't have any competition. Because Humpty Dumpty is he's the little puppet that sits on Nixon's knee. If Humphrey had won by a fluke, there wouldn't have been any difference in the White House. Little Humpty Dumpty would be sitting there. He's just right out of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he's their perfect little puppet, and he's a little milquetoast. You know, that wasn't an election in 68. And this is no election this time, because everyone's going to be caught off guard by surprise when